Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. During a meeting on North Korea's proliferation convened by Japan, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said that North Korea's growing nuclear capabilities are a direct threat to the United States, and Washington will use all necessary measures to defend itself against such aggression. Foreign Minister Taro Kono at the UN has also addressed North Korea.
It is important not only for the Security Council, but also for the entire international community to maximize its pressure on North Korea and to corner North Korea to change its policy.
Saturday, North Korean state media again targeted U.S. President Donald Trump for verbal attacks, referring to him as old lunatic Trump and warning his administration's officials to be prudent if they don't want to meet bitterer disgrace and destruction. South Africa's powerful ruling party is meeting to choose new leadership at a time when it has never been more divided. Over the coming days, about 5,000 delegates of the African National Congress will choose its new top slate, and in doing so will signal the end of the controversial rule of the embattled party leader and South African President Jacob Zuma. Zuma, whose mounting corruption scandals driven the party, will step down as leader at this conference. His successor will then be the presumptive ruling party presidential candidate when South Africa next votes in 2019. Zuma may continue as president of the country after the vote, but analysts predict that his party will try to convince him to step down before the election. This is VOA News. The damage assessment continues after an earthquake with a magnitude of 6.5 rocked the Indonesian capital of Jakarta and other cities on the country's island of Java late Friday, with authorities reporting at least two deaths.
Jadi sampai dengan saat ini, tiga orang meninggal dunia akibat gempa, baik dampak langsung maupun tidak langsung.
The management official says that so up to now, three people have died due to the earthquake, either directly or indirectly, and those buildings that are damaged are categorized as temporarily damaged. 228 houses, 152 were moderately damaged, 97 houses were slightly damaged, and 73 completely damaged. The UN Refugee Agency reports that aid agencies are bracing for another humanitarian emergency in Yemen as people flee from intensified fighting in frontline areas on Yemen's west coast. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says it has received reports that more than 1,400 people have fled from Hodeidah and Taiz governorates in the past few days. This follows the recent fighting in the Yemeni capital Sana'a and neighboring areas. The UNHCR says it is working with other aid agencies to scale up operations to help those who are fleeing and others to come. Agency spokesman Babar Balosh says emergency relief kits for 2,000 families in Hodeidah have been sent and more relief for thousands of other families is on the way. But he says Saudi Arabia's blockade of Yemen is harming emergency operations.
A senior member of Australia's Roman Catholic Church has rejected a key recommendation of a five-year inquiry into child sex abuse. More from Phil Mercer.
The report found that tens of thousands of children were abused in Australian institutions over past decades. Most of the perpetrators were members of the clergy and school teachers. For years, the vulnerable were preyed upon by paedophiles, while invariably those in charge looked the other way and did nothing. The government has yet to formally respond to the Commission's report, but Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull said the scale of abuse was a national tragedy.
I want to thank and honour the courage of the survivors and their families who've told, often for the first time, the dreadful stories of abuse that they received from people who actually owed them love and protection.
For 5 years, the Royal Commission heard agonising stories of rape and sexual assault.
I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
At the moment, I think that Cyril Ramaphosa is leading, and bringing Lindy Sisulu in really adds a lot of weight, because we are dealing here with a person from the legacy of struggle, stalwart, where her father was one of the leading people with Nelson Mandela.
South African Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa's effort to become the leader of the ANC receives a significant boost.
What it means is that in addition to what is being appropriated from the budgetary process, the military have additional resources available to them to combat what is left of Boko Haram challenges.
Nigerian government devotes $1 billion in the fight against Boko Haram and other militant groups.
It shows that perpetrators who recruit children to use them in armed conflict will be held accountable. They will be convicted and they will be forced to pay reparations.
And judges from the International Criminal Court award $10 million in reparations to former child soldiers from the DRC. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The South African ruling party, the African National Congress, or ANC, is meeting to choose new leadership. Over the coming days, delegates of the ANC will have new elected officials as President Jacob Zuma steps down as leader at the conference. His successor will then be the presumptive ruling party presidential candidate when South Africa goes to the polls in 2019. Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa faces Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, a former chairperson of the African Union, for the top leadership of the ANC. Ramaphosa's effort to become president of the party received a significant boost after Lindiwe Sisulu announced her support. For analysis, I reached Shadrack Guto, Professor Emeritus at the University of South Africa in the capital, Pretoria.
This is party elections taking place, and we don't know who will win, but Cyril Ramaphosa seems to be having an upper edge over Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma at this particular point. But for now, I think Cyril Ramaphosa seems to be on the lead. But you never know. For example, in your own country, those of us from outside didn't think that Donald Trump would win, but he did. But we are talking about Lindiwe Sisulu in this particular case. Is a very capable person, has been in many ministries since 1994, and from that point of view, she has a lot of experience, just like Dlamini Zuma was before she went to the African Union.
Some are saying that Cyril Ramaphosa seemed to have a little upper hand, as you said, because of Lindiwe Sisulu's backing, as well as the endorsement he got, or the approval he got from five provinces, while Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma got four. Do you share that sentiment?
Yes, I think that that is very clear at this particular point. By today, even the provinces that voted in favor of Dr. Dlamini Zuma, really some of them, their delegates will not vote. They will go to the elections, but they will not vote because the process they went through were not very clear. So that reduces the chances of Dr. Dlamini Zuma even more. But at the moment, I think that Cyril Ramaphosa is leading, and bringing Lindiwe Sisulu in really adds a lot of weight, because we are dealing here with a person from the legacy of struggle, stalwarts, where her father was one of the leading people with Nelson Mandela. And I think that adds some weight to what Lindy Wesetulu brings to the camp of the current leading candidate.
Critics of President Zuma are suggesting that he might be a drag on his former wife, Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, attaining the highest position of becoming the leader of the ANC, and some of the controversies he's been involved in, such as the Guptas and the allegations of a raft of corruption charges against him, might have dampened people's hopes of voting for Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma. Do you think these criticisms are justified?
They are very justified because even though Dr. Dlamini Zuma divorced the current president long ago, but they have a family and they have children, and therefore the perception of people on the ground, the voters, is that she's going to try and protect the family. And the family is involved in a lot of corrupt activities, including by the president himself. And from that point of view, I think the current president is a liability to Dr. Dlamini Zuma's candidacy.
Some are suggesting that President Zuma's power-sharing proposal was rejected outright by the ANC. What meaning do you read into that?
What that meant was that there was going to be a third player in the game, which is not part of the electoral system within the African National Congress. You don't have a group calling itself a unity group. That does not allow people to actually vote individually as delegates. We were supposed to have 5,232 candidates, people who would vote. Now they are reduced because of what I've already indicated, of some being disqualified. And therefore, I think that at this particular time, Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma chances are eroding, but we shall know by tomorrow what is really happening.
Shadrach Guto is Professor Emeritus at the University of South Africa. He spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria.
Nigerian governors have given President Muhammadu Buhari's government the permission to withdraw $1 billion from the excess crude account. The funds, the government says, will be used to combat Boko Haram. The approval came following a meeting of the National Economic Council at the presidential villa in the capital, Abuja. But critics say the funds are unlikely to be used to fight Boko Haram. Local media quoted Femi Fanikayude, a former aviation minister, saying the government plans to use the money to finance the 2019 elections, adding that part of the funds will be shared between party leaders and the cabal. For the latest development, I reached Garba Shehu, a spokesman for President Muhammadu Buhari.
This is money coming from earnings from crude oil, money that would have been shared between the three tiers of government, the federal government, the state, and local governments. But all of the three tiers of government came together and said, look, considering the problems at hand, Boko Haram and other security challenges in the country, let's commit this large amount of money in order to enhance the effectiveness of the ongoing war.
What impact does the government anticipate this amount of money will have on the fight against terrorism?
Well, what it means is that in addition to what is being appropriated from the budgetary process, the military have additional resources available to them to combat what is left of Boko Haram challenge. Because, you know, the issue is, it's a finishing job. Boko Haram has been defeated, but remnants still remain, and the place needs to be cleansed, especially the Sambisa forest. So given assurances that the military is ready to make that last push, I think that whatever support they need, they must get it. And this is part of that effort.
Critics of the government are saying, why so much money, particularly when Boko Haram have been defeated? Why pumping so much money if this is the narrative? Why so much money?
Well, in all of this interview, I've been saying that we are combating Boko Haram under other security challenges. This country has security challenges, whether they are having to do with the farmers and the herdsmen clashes, armed attacks by bandits, robbery, you know, cattle rustling, you know, occasional attacks on national assets, Niger Delta pipeline, and all of that, and the kidnapping. So the challenges are many. There cannot be too much money, you know, for national security, and national security can never be too expensive to be paid for.
So how do you respond to critics who say that the change in the command of those who are in the forefront of fighting Boko Haram in this case, and the, you know, the voting of this 1 billion to support this initiative shows that the narrative of the government technically defeating Boko Haram is questionable? This is what they said. How do you respond to them?
No, whoever questions the statement by government that Boko Haram has been either does not live in Nigeria or is not keeping pace with the developments in there. If this is a country in which so many cities had faced the kind of challenges we are talking about, nowhere was it, particularly in most of the northern cities, where Boko Haram had reached Lagos and Ibadan in southern Nigeria. So what are we talking about? Remnants of Boko Haram are on the fringes of Lake Chad, that's Sambisa Forest. Much of the country has been cleansed of their menace. And somebody says nothing has been achieved. No, no, please. They should tell another story.
What assurances will the government give the people of Nigeria, particularly those who have been affected by the violence that Boko Haram members have carried out in Nigeria? What impact and what message are you giving to the people, and what assurance are you giving them about the fight against Boko Haram once and for all?
The important message is that government is prepared to commit everything, money, whatever resources are available to the country, government will throw into this fight, because it is a fight for the survival and the well-being of the country and its own citizens. Can anybody give guarantees or assurances that with this there will be no more terrorist attacks in the country? No. Even the most advanced countries who have more sophisticated weaponry and intelligence, they get occasional attacks from terrorists. So terrorism has become a daily concern now, and that we should be on the lookout. Nobody will lower their guards and say that it is over and it will not happen again because you have thrown $1 billion into it. No. We continue to be vigilant. We continue to do our best to protect life and property of our citizens.
Garba Shehu is a spokesman for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He spoke with me from Abuja.
Judges from the International Criminal Court, or ICC, have awarded a $10 million in landmark reparations to former child soldiers recruited into Congolese militia. Warlord Thomas Lubanga, who was jailed for 14 years after being convicted in 2012 at the ICC for abducting boys and girls and forcing them into his Union of Congolese Patriot Rebel Group in the Eastern Ituri region in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The judges say Lubanga has to pay the fines to the victims. For reaction, I read Sandra Olson, Program Manager for Child Soldiers International, an NGO based in London.
Well, we think this is a very welcomed step. Of course, it started already at the conviction, which was an even more important step, but now it's followed up with the reparations. So this means this is a very important precedent, especially in a context where child recruitment is ongoing. Already in DRC this year, we've had hundreds of children recruited by armed groups. and elsewhere in the world. So it puts the subject on the agenda, which is very important.
The judges ordered $10 million as reparations for the victims. Although they identified some, there are thousands more that the judges themselves said have been victims to those atrocities committed in the DRC. But what impact do you think this reparations as ordered by the court will have on future insurgents who recruit child soldiers to fight their wars?
I think it has a difference because it shows that perpetrators who recruit children to use them in armed conflict will be held accountable. They will be convicted and they will be forced to pay reparations, and not only financial, but I'm hoping that we will see, as a part of the reparation plan, also some sort of public apology made by Thomas Lubanga, and that will set a precedent for other perpetrators as well. That would be a very important part of giving reparations, to acknowledge and take responsibility for their actions, and to, in that way, acknowledge for these children who have been recruited and their communities, for the perpetrator to say, it was not your fault. I was the adult who exploited you as a child. You are not responsible for this. I am. And that will have a huge impact on the reintegration and the recovery of these children.
Since the late 1990s, your organization has been campaigning against the recruitment of child soldiers to fight wars and insurgency and all that. What impact do you see this ruling having on your work as a tool to campaign against such acts?
I think DRC specifically is a very complicated context because there's been numerous conflicts that's been raging the country for the past 20 years. And since last year, we're now seeing a really complex context in the Kasai provinces that has now spread. And we're still seeing recruitment, we're still seeing attacks against children and using children in the eastern part of the country as well. So for DRC, it means that this is more so on the agenda. I'm hoping that it will encourage the government to work even more on the issue and specifically on holding perpetrators accountable. Because even if support has been given to children in DRC for the past 10 or 15 years now, and even if the government, the UN, and non-governmental organizations has been working really hard to stop the practice, if we're looking at the accountability side of it all, we don't see a lot of national convictions for child recruitment. So I'm hoping that this the ICC conviction that already happened in 2012, but now sort of revitalized thanks to the reparations being decided on, that this will again encourage the government to move forward on their own convictions.
As significant as this ruling is, do you think the international community or perhaps the regional blocs in Africa could take a cue from this to punish perpetrators of such who recruit child soldiers in their own struggle or whatever opposition they have against government?
I mean, as you say, it's very difficult to say. That is, of course, our hope, but it depends on the conflict and the government and the means that they have to pursue justice. But yes, that is our hope.
Sandra Olsen is the Program Manager for Child Soldiers International, an NGO. She spoke with me from London. Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa Friday appealed to his divided ruling ZANU-PF party to unite ahead of next year's elections. The party was divided for years over who should succeed longtime President Robert Mugabe, who was forced out last month. For VOA, Sebastian Nhofu has more from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
That is President Emmerson Mnangagwa late Friday appealing for unity to about 6,000 delegates at ZANU-PF's Extraordinary Congress. He spoke after the delegates endorsed him as the party's leader and its candidate for the 2018 elections. Mnangagwa took office less than a month ago after the army forced Robert Mugabe to step down as Zimbabwe's leader after 37 years. It seems the new president is aware of the challenges the country faces as it tries to revive a moribund economy.
The task at hand is that of rebuilding our great country. Government will leave no stone unturned to fully exploit the country's rich resources.
On Friday, Mnangagwa did not castigate his predecessor, whom he had worked with for more than 50 years before he was fired. He appealed for patience on economic matters, and he asked businesses and officials to shun corruption and unreasonable price increases.
Let's look forward with hope and love. Let the bygones be bygones. However, those who have been forgiven should not think we have forgotten. Let us turn over a new leaf and renew ourselves.
As Mnangagwa was speaking at Robert Gabriel Mugabe Square, several of his former allies were appearing before a judge at the Harare Magistrate Court. The defendants face criminal nuisance charges for wearing ZANU-PF hats on social media after being kicked out of the party. They include Ignatius Chombo, who was finance minister when Mugabe fired Mnangagwa as vice president on November 5th, triggering the events that led to Mugabe's downfall. This is the second time Chombo has been arrested since Mnangagwa came into office. Love Momaduku is the lawyer for Chombo.
And it's very likely that we may be under military rule. That means this is exactly the way the courts were operating under President Mugabe. And we see that just that. Unless there's a signal to tell them to change, we will just be in for a very difficult scenario.
Maduku wants the courts to dismiss the case of his clients. He says Mnangagwa is trying to punish all those that supported former First Lady Grace Mugabe, who was Mnangagwa's main rival in the fight to succeed President Mugabe. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The United Nations Children's Fund says that more than half of South Sudanese children have suffered abuse, trauma, and hunger over the past 4 years of war. UNICEF's report, Childhood Under Attack, released on the fourth anniversary of the start of the war, paints a gloomy picture of childhood in the East African nation. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The figures in the report make grim reading. The UN Children's Fund reports that more than 2,300 children have been killed or injured since South Sudan erupted into conflict in December 2013. And among those who are living, it says around 3 million have very little to eat. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouyrak says more than 1 million of those children are acutely malnourished, including 280,000 who are suffering from acute, severe malnutrition.
The child suffering from acute malnutrition is a child who is at risk of dying, at least 9 times more likely to die than a child who has a correct nutrition. Also, child rights violations. In total, more than 117,000 children have been affected in reported incidents of grave violations against children since the beginning of the conflict.
Those, he says, include hundreds of incidences of rape and sexual assault, leading to many cases of psychological distress. He says there has been an upsurge in the forcible recruitment of child soldiers, with more than 19,000 children in both government and rebel armed groups. UNICEF says South Sudanese children are in desperate need of every sort of humanitarian assistance. Unfortunately, it notes the ability of aid workers is hampered by the inability to access insecure parts of the country and a chronic shortage of money. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
High life in the dance hall.
Open mic to gain of life.
Open mic to floating song.
Open the mic.
Heal and take
the mic. Order a bet you any. Order a bossy mommy. Baby, we be dancing in your dance hall. Baby, I'm not done with this. This ain't time for cocoa tea. I'm gonna give you that thing that you want. Baby, when you turn for me, oh, that thing that's too hot for me. Girl, I wanna post you all over my wall. You said, what is your name again? Cause I'm feeling your game. This one here ain't not be small. So be ready for take me far.
Nice whining, girl. Nice,
you got something I'm looking for.
Nice.
We wanna go long. This girl I wipe on the fat back, bringing it on, bringing it on. Girl, you feel jerk it up, jerk it up, jerk it up. The way you rock it and wind it, turn it on, turn it on. Girl, you feel know you're the boss of my world. I endorse you, baby. You've been very fine.
I choose none other girl like you. Shorty with the body of a goddess, my boo. Hey, and I bet you a chain glue. Yeah, the better form to the shoe. Yeah, when we carry them goose, won't feed the man like ooh. Yeah, make you taste my ginger woman. Something to come out your fever, come on. In the night when it's cold, I go be cardigan. When it's sun, you go see safe looking be man. Hey, at the end of the day, you my one only baby. The him I will be fear you. They make me elevate. Open, I will give me taste. In the fake, you be great, baby, baby. Make you lay in my place. Shall it go on in the days when we run, but like babes. Now we grown and we age and the form in the shape. Bigger than I'm a year. Maybe let's celebrate. Flow can't shit the bust on my brain like hey.
Open mic, open
hardships and sufferings will come no more. Problems will one day get up me, yes I know. And I'm sure, truly sure, that my star will shine one day. I'll keep on trying till my star will shine. I'll keep on trying till my star will shine. Yeah, come on, my shining star. Come on, my shining star. I'll keep on trying till my star will shine. I'll keep on trying till my star will shine. Come on, my shining star. Come on, my shining star.
obstacles, and I've seen many sufferings. Every day I pray that one day my star will shine, and my faith is so strong that one day will be mine. I'll keep on trying, I'll keep on trying, I'll keep on trying till my star will shine. I'll keep on trying, I'll keep on trying, I'll keep on trying till my star will shine. Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, my shining star. Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, my shining star. Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, my shining star, shining star, yay, shining star, come on now, oh, shining star, come on, come, shining star. I know we'll shine one day. I'm sure, surely sure, my star will shine one day. Come on, come on, come on, my shining star, shining star, yeah, my shining star. Shining star, come on now, my shining star, shining star, I need you now. Shining star, come on now. Come on, come on, my shining star. Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, my shining star, shining star.
Yeah. Kekele, sabroso.
Bolingone sukali, nasima bololo. Eko milo kolo sanza, apre kupo boyani. Olingo de paradizu, nasima eko miafe. Oko miko banga banga, sinte plena sukiwana. Sokyo bunga lina yote, koluka libalate. Oko mona mpasi apamba. Oko ma koregrete, oko lela lela pamba, oko pesa nani fote. Bolingo ne basi wiza, eza la kama wate, soki embeti yo fimbo, apre. Colina moto e tumbo e bandeli ba plaisir. O mi pesa come o boia, nana ke na bulungani. So como na mina nute, oko simbali balate, oko funa pamba pamba, oko luka ba raison.
Papa Noel,
sarakata pare
Olingo nesu kalina sime komi bololo mama
E sarakata pare
Kana ele kinga bolinga komi kopesa ngapasi
E sarakata pare
Olingo pemi sanga ingana pema mokeo
E sarakata pare
Nakacha bolingo Masaka nakate kaso
E sarakata pare
Olingo yaka, olingo zonga Olingo pemi sanga Chipsi kasa ye
David Masson, et je n'y vois rien, ça me tombe au pouvoir.
Nasima ekoti confiance okominde okamwisa Sokyonza na chance te okoki kobalate ato salinyo sopamba okolonge tumbate okoswana swana pamba okopesa nani pote
Salinga lelo yeba baby sivi ya mwana moto Tika kosa kana keba Mokili tu hatu Moyo salinga lelo yeba Oh baby sivi ya mwana moto Tika kosa kana keba Yosi yosi lisa posa ya boli
Confidence mulembe
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter and producer Douglas Impuga, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if you don't sell your head, no one will buy it. I'm your host, Peter Klote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The recent legislative and municipal elections in the Republic of Equatorial Guinea were a chance for the government there to live up to the goal of widening the country's democratic space, a goal that was the focus of Equatorial Guinea's celebrated National Dialogue of 2014. As longtime President Obiang Nguema Mbasogo said at the time, democracy and national unity must be priorities in the problems that affect the nation. Where there are no public liberties, there cannot be institutional development. Unfortunately, as U.S. Ambassador to Equatorial Guinea, Julie Furuta Toy, wrote in a recent op-ed, the opportunity for the government to expand the country's democratic space, demonstrate that it hears the voice and the will of the people, and improve its image on the international stage was missed in November. The elections were a step back, she wrote. The balloting of candidates did not allow the public to vote freely for candidates to represent them at any level, since the voters only had the choice to vote for a party. The members of the public were registered to vote in a process that was not transparent and was not observed by the international or domestic observers. And the final count of the votes was not at all transparent or free. Additionally, restrictions on internet and communication systems were enforced. Reportedly, the Democratic Party of Equatorial Guinea, the party of President Nguema, won the legislative and municipal elections with 92% of the vote. At the Chamber of Deputies in Malabo, only a single member of the opposition from the Citizens' Party for Innovation was elected, leaving 99 seats to the party in power. Ambassador Furuta Toy emphasized that a vibrant and loyal opposition is necessary to create economic opportunities for everyone. Without hearing the voices, without an independent representative democracy, the government limits the ability of its citizens to make informed choices for the future of the nation. As she wrote earlier this year, the greatest resource of Equatorial Guinea is not its abundant supply of oil and gas. The greatest resource of Equatorial Guinea is actually her people, said Ambassador Furuta Toy. It is past time for the leaders of Equatorial Guinea to ensure that Equatorial Guineans are allowed the democratic space required for their country to flourish.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.